Dr. Adriana is going to talk about implementing a standardized assessment of preterm labor as a hospital quality improvement project. Can you tell me where you're from?
I'm from Sacramento, and I'm the chair for the preterm labor assessment toolkit for the March of Dimes. Uh-huh. I'm also a partner in a private practice and a faculty member at UC Davis.
Great. Okay. Thank you. Is this your first trip to
San Francisco?
No. Yeah, I'm sure. APHA?
Yes.
All right. Well, okay. How about that? Are you a UCSF graduate?
No. No. I don't. I went to Columbia, then went to San Diego. All right. So on behalf of the March of Dimes, I would like to thank the American Public Health Association for the opportunity to present our statewide quality improvement project in obstetrics. And this is in the realm of the triage unit in labor and delivery. So if you're familiar with the triage unit, I'm sure some of you have been to the triage unit. This kind of focuses on that. Some of my disclosure. And I would like to thank my co-authors for the hard work in ushering this project into realization. Now, for our learning objectives after this presentation, we hope that you will understand the key steps to implement and evaluate preterm labor assessment toolkit at your facility if you plan to use this. You will be able to describe how implementing standardized protocols and clinical algorithms for preterm labor assessment can improve consistency in clinicians' decision-making and increase the correct disposition decisions for patients while maintaining maternal-fetal safety. Lastly, to find the opportunity to partner with hospitals on evidence-based quality improvement activities such as this. Almost 500,000 babies are born preterm in the United States. The peak, as was alluded to in the earlier presentation, was in 2006. And then for some reason, from 2006 now to 2011, we've slowly dipped, and we're below 12% at this point. The burden of cost has been estimated to about $26 billion as of 2005 by the Institute of Medicine. And this includes the annual cost of preterm birth-related medical and educational expenses, as well as the associated loss of productivity. As reported from the 2012 publication from the March of Dimes entitled Born Too Soon, the Global Action Report on Preterm Birth, the U.S. ranks 131 out of 184 countries in preterm birth rate. And this rate is tied with Somalia, Thailand, and Turkey. The sequelae of preterm birth includes neurological abnormalities, including cerebral palsy, which is a main focus, chronic lung disease, learning disabilities, including autistic spectrum, and early death. In 2002, the National March of Dimes announced taking on the issue of prematurity, and the California chapter convened a summit of public health and medical experts to discuss the issue. Preterm labor was identified as an intervention opportunity to improve maternal and infant outcomes. Although the present science could not successfully stop preterm labor once it has begun, there is great value in delaying delivery for 48 hours in order to prepare the fetus for premature life. In the majority of cases, only 10% of patients will deliver preterm when the diagnosis of preterm labor and the majority of women are exposed to unwanted interventions. Recognize the gravity of the problem, a cooperative agreement between March of Dimes California Chapter and Sider Medical Center Sacramento was established to create a multidisciplinary task force and to explore the triage practices in assessing preterm labor, and to determine if standardization of the triage process will improve the quality of determining disposition of women at risk for preterm birth. In the same year, a task force was established of more than 40 diverse members in the field of maternal child health who reviewed the current literature at that time and best practices on triage for preterm labor. The overarching question that was asked of everyone was, can we design a toolkit that can be used by every type of maternity hospital? After recognizing the wide variation and inconsistency of protocols, policies, and procedures, it was clear that the goal was to create a standardized approach of assessing preterm labor. Recognizing that most facilities do not have a standardized methodology for assessing and making the diagnosis of preterm labor, resulting in starting medical treatment or admitting of a patient that may not be indicated. National experts' input was obtained as the toolkit was being developed and was followed with a separate national expert review prior to obtaining endorsement from national organizations. The March of Dimes Preterm Labor Assessment Toolkit, as we all call PLAT, all the co-authors like that name, was the result of this process, and the first edition was released in 2005 with letters of support from the Society for Maternal-Fetal Medicine and District 9 of the American Congress of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, or ACOG. The publication was developed detailing a step-by-step method to support clinical staff in accomplishing these goals, hospitals that wanted to adopt the toolkit. A second edition is forthcoming in 2012, and that has been revised to include current evidence-based recommendations and to bridge the gap between the ACOG Practice Bulletin 127 and 130, which are focused on preterm labor management and prevention of preterm birth, respectively. Using standardized protocols significantly reduces poor outcomes and increase patient safety by reducing unwanted intervention and preventing unplanned perinatal complications. Standardization will correctly identify the minority of women who would need interventions to prepare for preterm delivery and improve outcomes. This consists of using short-term tocolysis, which is the drug that we use to slow down labor, to prolong the gestation long enough to administer antenatal corticosteroids, to reduce the risk of respiratory distress syndrome, magnesium sulfate to reduce the risk of cerebral palsy, and to allow maternal transport to a facility with a neonatal intensive care unit or assemble a neonatal team for delivery. The preterm labor assessment toolkit includes the following components and has been expanded and updated in the forthcoming second edition. Uterine contractions are confusing. If a diagnosis is based on this most common symptom of preterm labor, up to 75% of women will not deliver preterm. Contractions are the most common reason women come to the labor and delivery triage unit for evaluation and accounts for up to 95% of triage congestion. March of Dimes Preterm Labor Assessment Toolkit aims to ensure that with contractions, cervical change is uniformly assessed in women presenting with signs and symptoms of preterm labor, uniform practices that lead to correct disposition decisions. The algorithm, protocol, and tools outlined in PLAT drive change in assessment of behavior shown in the purple arrow, resulting in a correct disposition decision shown in the red box. These, in turn, lead to improved outcomes for symptomatic women. Implementation using the MAP-IT rapid cycle illustrated on the right half of the slide begins with mobilizing a quality improvement team to break institutionalized barriers in hospitals' culture. An administrator, a physician, and a nurse champion need to be identified as ambassadors for the PLAT initiative. A data collection champion will be helpful to support tracking and evaluation. A baseline survey and chart audit will assist in identifying present practices, educational, and equipment needs. A paternal transport process and inter-hospital agreement, if needed, must be in place before the initiative can be introduced as a quality improvement measure. Education needs are met by either grand rounds presentations or one or more town hall Q&A sessions. If the nursing staff is not skilled in performing sterile speculum exams, a link to web-based didactic education is included in PLAT along with a link to skill certification checklists. Finally, perform a review of patient education materials and home care instructions. Update and follow-up should be performed if necessary. Samples of policies, procedures, and orders are available in PLAT that assist hospitals with any need to modification. These documents are provided to serve as a comparative guide to existing protocols and policies. Equipment needs refer to any adequate number and size of speculums in the triage area, the availability of on-call transvaginal ultrasound, and availability of rapid fetal fibronectin tests. To help establish consensus and buy-in, we recommend convening an OBGYN department meeting with invitations to radiology and laboratory representatives to discuss changes in the protocol, feedback of steps that have been accomplished in a rollout event, as well as the reception to the changes proposed and of the progress of the implementation will help the department understand the need for quality improvement measures. Longitudinal collection of data and timely reporting to the department as a recurring line item in the meeting agenda will help inform progress in standardizing preterm labor assessment. Any implementation adjustment can be made in a timely manner by the quality improvement team. As of this presentation, we have collected data from 18 hospitals. We anticipate to receive data from 3 additional hospitals by year end and concluding our evaluation with a total of 21 hospitals. Although our submitted abstract spoke of an initial goal of 25 hospitals, we will not be able to achieve our target due to changes in leadership, staff, and priorities at our 4 partnering hospitals. Compliance was assessed by adherence to the following decision points: the sterile speculum examination to determine the status of the cervix and amniotic fluid membranes. A significant increase was seen in this procedure. Number 2, assessment of cervical status to determine the degree of dilation and effacement at initial encounter. A significant increase was also seen determining the cervical status. Assessment of cervical change, which is number 3, to determine change in dilation, effacement, consistency, and position at an interval or prior to this position. A significant increase was seen in cervical change assessment. Number 4, no tocolysis used prior to completion of assessment. Treatment for preterm labor is not initiated unless assessment is complete and the preterm labor diagnosis is made. Number 5, no antenatal corticosteroids used prior to completion of assessment. Corticosteroid prophylaxis for RDS is not initiated until assessment is complete and preterm labor diagnosis is made. Number 6, correct disposition decision maintains that discharge, admit, or transport decision is based on complete cervical change assessment. A significant increase was seen in this procedure. Number 7, time from patient presentation at hospital to disposition decision is less than 5 hours. To allow for timely intervention for women in true preterm labor or timely rule out of preterm labor and correct discharge instructions. And number 8, patients who are discharged home are provided with educational materials describing the signs and symptoms of preterm labor and when to call the provider and or to return to the hospital. These are reviewed with the patient to ensure understanding. This bar graph represents the results of the last slide, including the overall compliance with PLAT shown in the far right. Use of the various procedures that compose the PLAT protocol increased after implementation of the key measures or decision points. There were statistically significant increases in adherence to 4 decision points, as well as an overall compliance with PLAT. The decision points were implementation of the sterile speculum exam, the assessment of cervical status, assessment of cervical change, and correct disposition decision. Distribution of educational material to patients discharged home and delivered was close to 90% of both pre- and post-implementation and remained virtually unchanged over time. Antenatal corticosteroids was not used prior to disposition and over 90% of both pre- and post remained virtually unchanged over time. Time to disposition changed in a negative direction, but this finding was not statistically significant. The time increase may have resulted from additional time spent by clinician in carefully working through the algorithm and protocol. The data presented in this figure represent the first 3 months after implementation, the earliest stage in the learning curve. As the learning curve progresses, it is expected that encounter the disposition time will decrease. This table shows the change in PLAT compliance for disposition decision. There was an increase in disposition decisions based on completed cervical change assessment for patients who were admitted or transferred, and for patients sent home and delivered. However, the increase was statistically significant only for patients sent home and delivered. This is consistent with the clinical observation and from published data that the majority of symptomatic patients are not in active preterm labor. We anticipate that with a larger sample, the change in disposition based on complete cervical change assessment for admits and transfer may reach statistical significance. The pink line represents the pre-implementation compliance, and the green line or teal represents the post-implementation compliance. The index for compliance for 1 to 2 decision points in the pre-implementation group decreased from 8.6 to 3.0, 3 months into the project, while the index for compliance from 7 to 8 decision points pre-implementation increased from 17.7 to 31.2, 3 months into the quality improvement process. This represents a statistically significant change in clinical behavior as a direct effect of implementing PLOT. PLOT implementation changed clinical practice behavior in labor and delivery triage units. The standardization of triage evaluation resulted in proper and safe disposition decisions where a majority of patients were discharged home and delivered, decreasing the likelihood of unwanted intervention. Based on our assessment, it will take more than 3 months to ascertain full compliance, but the promise of sustained improvement is probable. The apparent conservation of resources will translate into dollar savings consistent with published data while maintaining utmost perinatal safety. What are the lessons learned? Passionate ambassadors are the key to success for any quality improvement process to succeed. The power of data feedback brings a clear and loud picture to support the need for change. Quality improvement integration will lead to sustainability. Constant feedback and shared learning with network hospital encourages peer support and healthy competition. It takes time for clinical behavior change to occur with variability in rate of late and early adopters. Rapid cycles, as described in the previous slides, will increase the chance for rapid adaptation. The first edition of PLAT has been implemented in over 30 hospitals across California. PLAT has received national attention, most recently in statewide perinatal conferences in Tennessee, Arizona, and Missouri. The authors are comprised of voluntary experts from California and at the national level, with expert assistance from the March of Dimes staff. We learned a great deal through the implementation of the first PLAT. We learned how often women do not receive a complete assessment when they are in triage for preterm labor. Making change in hospital practice takes time. It is very important to build case to support the need for and drive change. We could not overemphasize the importance of baseline data collection and post-implementation data feedback to further refine implementation process. To avoid confusion, it is very important to outline step-by-step implementation guidelines. Last and most importantly, having the correct champions in place will move the quality improvement process forward. This revision has been designed to capture the lessons learned and provide tools to assess hospitals without making their own case and to track the progress in implementing the improved version of the 2012 March of Dimes Preterm Labor Assessment Toolkit. Thank you.
Thank you. If the other speakers will come back up here, and we have some time, and I think we should take it to talk. I'm sorry, you may have to move a little bit because it is literally freezing up here.
Yeah, just change that for
you. Oh, just put that. I think you guys will have enough chairs. Just pull that. And come on up here. I'm not going to sit down, so you know. Now, what sorts of questions do we have for these folks? We've talked a lot about C-sections. We've talked about the impact of premature labor on C-sections. We've talked about the positive impact of changing that through centering and centering parenting. What sorts of questions do you all have for the speakers? Yes. Could you say your name also?
Are doing the fact this
this concept of assessment for prepared labor, you can move this into assessment of labor. And we were trying to bridge the gap. We have another initiative called the Non-Medical Indicated Delivery, less than 39 weeks, which Marshall Dimes will own. So if you link between the two, you can actually bridge over that and then talk about assessment of triage for labor patients on the triage unit. So women who do not meet criteria for active labor, that means if they're less than 4 centimeters dilated, they don't contract, their spacement is not more than 80%, they need to get out of the triage
unit. Before we go, one just second, because tomorrow the meeting is here in this building in 300. And we will be there because there's governing council and everybody. I'll be there at 6:30 in the morning, and we'll probably be there to about 8:15. But if anyone is going to be there, I'd like you to give me the word so we know, so we're not waiting unnecessarily. It's hard to get things done, so if you come closer to this. I know it's early, but we'll bring donuts or something. Maybe something else. Other questions? I guess one question I have for you. It seemed to me, was I misreading your thing, that there had not been a lot of change yet? Is that what you were showing, that things are working, but there really hasn't? We haven't.
Well, what we actually managed to show in the first 3 months is that we actually changed the behavior by making everyone think alike and do everything in uniform, uniformly with free action. So a lot of these women would come in with contractions. And then when they come into the unit, they get hydrated or an IV started and the contractions would go away. And then once it has gone away, they would just send them home without really truly assessing them. If their service is changing or whether or not. I mean, I've seen a lot of cases where patients are sent home and then a few hours later they would come back and they're almost delivering a preterm baby. So the incomplete assessment is what kind of got us into this.
I don't know what size hospitals were you working at, because you're talking about like small community hospitals where I work. There's no provider enough, so you're talking about dragging someone in 2 in the morning to do, you're calling in ultrasound to your transvaginal, you're calling in a provider to do the sterile sex because of their supervision. In my facility, they do labor nurses jump in. So of course there's going to be incomplete assessment at 2 in the morning because everyone's going in.
Well, I totally agree with you, and actually you're the target of this topic. The study that we did with 18 hospitals, there are 2 tertiary units with 2 residency trainings on the building together. But the majority of those hospitals were up in the community. Now, the toolkit, if you look at the algorithms, it's not dependent on transvaginal ultrasound for people having it. There is a certain aspect of the toolkit that actually describes where you don't have these two instruments to use, ultrasound and people having connected. You can actually physical tell these down 2 hours into a while, noting how much contraction, noting the spacing and dilation. And when you do a pelvic exam, the most important aspect is dilation. If that dilation doesn't change, she's not a researcher.
Other questions for other speakers? Yes.
I actually have a few questions. One for Andrea. Do you have access? It was very interesting for me to see those 10 classifications, but and you stratified by age and race. Do you have access to EMI or whether they have pre-existing conditions? Because I think without looking at the women also, rates are increasing.
We have whatever is in the hospital discharge record, which includes a diagnosis codes and procedure codes, but we didn't go to that next level of the analysis because it would be too much for one paper representation.
I know that in 2007 they just added the EMI of the woman.
Mm-hmm. The whole subject is that I love to look at. I actually wanted to make one comment if I could. In your presentation in general, we tend to be somewhat baby-centric in our discussions of risks associated. And both in secondary infection and in ARC, multiple pregnancies, we talk about the risks to babies. There are incredible risks to the mother for the baby. And those are an important part of the equation too. Who they are, etc. Not what we're talking about, but it always strikes me that we miss talking about what the mother thinks. That's my soapbox.
I was surprised. I really like hearing about the different interventions and best practices that work, and I'm kind of surprised that there is such variability in providers, like, and where I've heard that where they get received their training, that there's not some sort of standardization at the higher level, like before they even get to the hospital, have some standardization on that. I mean, I know in California, Southern California is a completely different country than Northern California in terms of cesarean rates. It's like night and day. So, is there anything being done about the training?
Well, there's these, other than these public health interventions, I think a strong advocate, I think, to get towards awareness about it, but not really. So, ACOG, the guidelines around when and how to do cesarean are so very vague, and they really actually don't take too much of a stand. Either way, on when it's medically indicated or when it's not, they really leave it up to the discretion of the provider. So I think it is it's on their shoulders a little bit to kind of create those guidelines and encourage those to be implemented.
Actually,
I have
a comment to that. In Miami, so I'm most familiar with what's going on in South Florida. The C-section rate in Miami-Dade County is over 50%, and the variation is dramatic. If you go to Kendall Regional, it's 69%, and you go just a few miles down the road to Jackson South, it's like 28%. So the practice variation is a huge issue at the provider level, at the facility level, and at the state level.
You have a question back there?
Yeah, I might be a little behind in this literature, but one of the aspects that's important is physician scheduling and how the pass-offs are happening in administration. Has there been any work on trying to improve how that happens so that at the end of the physician shift, we don't see this horrible spike in cesarean sessions?
That's a good question. When I was doing my list review, that was brought up as scheduling and really inductions too, scheduling inductions, that was common just for convenience for mother and provider. But I didn't see any interventions looking at addressing that issue. So again, unless...
Do you think that with the 39-week initiative, we'll see the cesarean section rate go down because we're not trying to induce people who aren't physically ready to deliver?
I mean, that is the intent of the program. They're making that assumption. I think in a few more years, we'll have good data about that.
I'd like to comment on that. I'd like to comment on that as being the first one on the added side and obstetrician who actually tackles it. And also being the director, obstetric director for the hospital that I cover. Attacking reduction of cesarean section rate by attacking the cesarean section rate itself, I think it's a fruitless thing to do because we've done it over the last 25 years and nothing has happened. But establishing certain standards within the way people practice, the way obstetricians practice, I think can reduce the cesarean section rate. One is the non-medical indicated delivery less than 39 weeks. If everyone dialed onto that, and no expert opinion tells a physician that yes, you can deliver in 38 or 37, it will reduce the cesarean section rate. If we admit patients to the triage unit, only patients that actually can labor, and then not allow patients who are not enrolling in the triage unit, that will reduce the cesarean section rate. Asking doctors to be responsible and putting the indication why you can convey a use statement is another way to reduce the infection rate. But it's not attacking the cesarean section rate itself, just the problem. It's actually modifying the behavior of the doctor to do certain things the way they're used to do.
I completely agree. The way I kind of summarized it was saying, it's just the increase in cesarean section rate is more a symptom of a larger problem than the problem itself. You kind of have to get to the core root of the problem to address cesarean section.
I'm going to go with one more question back there just because y'all are going to miss all things.
So kind of piggyback on what you're saying, you know, I think when you put in policies like the 39 weeks, then you do influence physician practice and care. And I had decided, and one of our quality improvement projects for OBGYN is looking at reducing the infection rate among first time moms. So one thing we found in part review is that doctors are inducing patients when they're not really in labor. So when you're establishing guidelines and developing hard stops and making sure people fill out forms and talk about why they're trying to induce a woman who's not really in labor, that it really does sort of change the standard of practice and people are able to look at what they're doing. And I think there's like research, you know, some study that came out that says, you know, the four is now maybe six. And so I think people should really looking at what
the practice and implement them, and I think, like you said, not attacking the sexual, but also to sort of physician practice. Ladies, any other comments? Yes?
I just heard from someone recently that in South Carolina, they have changed the both private insurance and Medicaid reimbursement policy. So that elective C-sections or elective reductions before 39 weeks are not being reimbursed. And that's what it will take to really change.
That's happening in Tennessee as well.
And there's also a law infected.
Yes.
I just want to comment to the cultural aspect. I've done some work in Haiti in a hospital that had a large influx of American obstetricians start working. And they saw an increase in cesarean rate when the physicians came without any changes in maternal mortality or the neonatal mortality. So a lot of it has to do with culture as well, and a culture that we just bring with us no matter where we go.
What a black cloud, yes. Carol.
So I just read an article that came out in the ACOG Journal about the more maternal morbidity having had an increase of 75% in the last 5 years. And anyway, I just thought I'd add that in there, the serious question. But the other thing is, I come from a real practice, a hospital practice in Tennessee, Southern Central Tennessee. We have over half of our practice is old order Amish, and about 70% of them are grand mal heads, so it's not all low-risk practice. And our pursuing session is low-risk
After 24 years, our birth center's section rate is 9.3. And obviously, I know whenever you present this, the obstetrician says, but you're selecting your patients. You're darn dude. That's the whole point of it, you know. Not every woman needs to be treated as high risk. And God willing, we're going to treat the high risk women absolutely appropriately. But that's what the triage is all about. Thank you.